WebAdvisor at my.hfcc.edu or from the HFCC homepage at www.hfcc.edu.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Arthur C. Clarke once observed, "Two possibilities exist. Either we are alone in the universe, or we are not. Both are equally terrifying." Join your host, David Twitchell, the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m., when he and special guests examine the scientific evidence on We Are Not Alone, right here on WHFR.FM 89.3. That's the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. We are not alone.
Ever have this conversation with yourself? Local news and alternative views. I know. You don't know. I know what I need to know. You don't know enough. I read news on the internet. You don't know local. I check into Facebook a lot. You don't know facts. I watch television news. You don't know in depth. I read the local newspapers. Better, but you still don't know background analysis, the real voices of the newsmakers. Then what should I do to really know local news and alternative views? You need to listen to the new WHFR Journal, broadcast live Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on WHFR 89.3 FM, or get their podcast from www.whfr.fm. So, now I'll know.
Are you facing foreclosure? Then come down to Megalow and Partners. We're a mortgage rescue company, and we can help you keep your house. The process is simple. The results are guaranteed 100%. That's the Megalow and Partners promise. Provided you submit to our plans for galactic domination. No, no, I'm kidding. Megalow and Partners, your partner in foreclosure prevention. Stop in anytime.
If you're facing foreclosure, make sure you're talking to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. That's 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Mr. Stan Gordon. Stan was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and has lived in the area all of his life. And he has had an interest in the UFO and Bigfoot phenomenon since he was a boy. He has conducted an on-scene investigations of thousands of mysterious encounters across Pennsylvania, and has earned a mention in the International Who's Who in Ufology directory by Robert D. Boyd. Stan received the 1987 MUFON Meritorious Achievement in a UFO Investigation Award, which was the first award of its kind. In 1998, he received the EBE Film Award for Best Historical UFO Documentary at the 8th Annual International UFO Congress. Stan is also the author of Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Casebook. He has been interviewed on countless radio, TV shows, and documentaries. And we're pleased to have him online with us today. Welcome to the show, Mr. Gordon.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate you having me on.
It is our pleasure. And, yeah, I finally had the pleasure of meeting you at the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Conference in Pittsburgh this past October. And it turned out to be quite a successful affair, didn't it?
Yes, it was. They seem to get more and more people who have been coming in the last few years, and I guess the audience is getting from further distances as well, coming from out of state. So it provides a lot more medium for the speakers and the people there and the displayers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was advertising at conference, both Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, for the last couple of shows before October. And I see there were a couple of people from the Michigan area that were there. They came from all over.
They did, and so that's always a good thing, because I guess a lot of the different conferences with UFOs are unfortunately starting to dwindle from what I've been hearing.
Really? I don't know. I don't know. There were over 500 people, from what I heard. Did I hear right? At the Pittsburgh one?
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah, so that was lucky. That's my understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, it worked out well. I spoke there, and you spoke there. We traded books, and I had the pleasure of reading your book. And it was quite informational. There seems to be a lot happening in Pennsylvania area.
Well, there always has been. I mean, historically, it's always been a hotbed for many, many strange reports. Mm-hmm. And I started in this when I was 10 years old, a long time ago. I've been doing it now for over 52 years. And I can tell you right from the start of the program, in all the years I've been doing this, I've never personally seen a UFO or a Bigfoot. I've seen lots of evidence out in the field investigating. I've interviewed thousands of witnesses, mm-hmm. but I've never had my own personal experience.
Uh-huh. Do you wish you could?
Well, it keeps me skeptical, and I think I would like to see something, but that day has not come yet.
Ah, very good. Well, maybe it will. Maybe E.T. knows that you're out here looking for them. They'll make their presence known. They did to me once, so maybe they will with you. And tell us about your book, your investigation on the Kecksburg incident. Now, that seems to be a pretty well-known incident, but for those of our listeners here in the Dearborn area, Dearborn, Michigan, and all around the world, in fact, who are not familiar with this, tell us about it and what your investigation revealed.
Well, I started in that when I was 16 years old back in 1965.
Hmm.
And that happened on December 9th, late afternoon. It was about 4:47 p.m. local, so it was just about getting dark at that time.
Mm.
And I remember the night very well, because I was going to listen to the big KDK radio station here in Pittsburgh. They had a talk radio show, and it was called Contact. And that night, they were having on a guest on UFOs and flying saucers, which happened to be Frank Edwards, who was a reporter who had written some books on flying saucers.
Hmm.
And I was tuned into the show that night to find that almost the entire program was being focused on these many reports of this fiery object that had been seen over a widespread area and had come in over the greater Pittsburgh area. And at that point, and I guess we'll talk about around the that show, I believe, was on at 8 p.m., and reports were coming in to the newsrooms. Their wire services were, there was reports coming in on the different AP and UPI teletypes, and they were beginning to read the wire stories. They were interviewing witnesses. People were calling in about it, and so almost the entire program, we were talking about whatever this thing may have been. And as the evening continued on, reports indicated that whatever this object was, it apparently fell in an area in Westmoreland County, about approximately about 40-some miles southeast of Pittsburgh in Westmoreland County. And then they got much more intriguing that evening, because reports began to come in that the military had now arrived in the small rural farming community to search for this object, this unidentified flying object, which reportedly had fallen, and they were going to search for this object. And I remember back then we had the old black and white console TV, and I was running back and forth between the radio and the old TV to see what was going on. And they were actually breaking in with live news reports on from KDK TV and talking about the fact that the military was coming in to look for this UFO.
Wow.
And it was quite an exciting evening. I wasn't even driving yet. I had no way to get out there, but I was checking all the media as best I could to try to keep up to date what was happening that evening, and was awaiting the newspaper stories the next day. And it was quite exciting to find here was the front headlines on the local paper, the Greensburg Tribune Review, which had two different editions. And it was the big header story. The first edition mentioned unidentified flying object falls near Kecksburg Army ropes off area. And it went into detail about the fact that something reportedly fell, that nobody was being allowed anywhere near the object. One of the reasons supposedly was that whatever may have fallen may have been radioactive and nobody was going to be allowed near it, and that the area was being cordoned off. And it was quite an exciting story. And then the later edition had a number of additional stories, and where they talked about more witness accounts. Of course, and the theory started coming in that what people saw may have been a meteor in the sky. And then there was another story in there which came to the fact that search fails to find object. And I began to look at that one very carefully and realized that officially they came to the conclusion that nothing had fallen, that there was a search for the object, that nothing reportedly was found. And people had reportedly just seen a bright meteor in the sky officially, that nothing had fallen to the ground. And that's how officially the story is today. I remember days after that event happened, there was a lot of talk around the community of people who said they saw a large military flatbed tractor trailer truck carrying a large tarped object out of the air at a high rate of speed late that night, actually early the next morning. Of course, that wasn't in the newspaper.
Oh, no.
So, you know, I was quite a young guy at the time. I was interested in the subject. Tried to get what information I could. There was very little information out there, very little information, really, when you got down to it in the newspaper. And over a period of time, which went to weeks and months and years later, I began to get a lot of input from friends and neighbors and witnesses and relatives of people who were there that night. And as time went on and talked to all these individual people, and we began to find that so many of these people didn't know each other. In fact, a lot of them didn't live around the area. They came in that night from outside the area after hearing these reports that an object had reportedly fallen, and a lot of people descended on that community that night. There were hundreds of people descending on this small, narrow farm road and trying to get a glimpse of what fell into the woods, which they didn't realize that from the road they were looking, basically by then it was already dark, it was far, far down on the opposite side of the woods at the bottom of the ravine where they couldn't see really what was going on.
Hmm.
And not only did the civilians show up, but so did the news media. And in fact, there were numerous reporters from all over the Pittsburgh area, radio, TV, newspaper people, who were on the scene that night. And a number of them that I talked to all verified the fact that there was a military presence there. And Bob Gaddy was the reporter for the local Tribune Review, who was on the scene that night. And I had many interviews with him over the years, and Bob was convinced that there was something down in the woods, and he wanted to go down, take a look, but the authorities on the scene forbid him to go down. And I guess at one point he said, well, if I get down, he said, you'll be something along the line, you'll be arrested. And so that's how the story remained till today. But what we now know, at talking to hundreds of witnesses who had either direct or indirect knowledge of the case, and where we got so much information, and what's so interesting is that even today, while you've seen a number of TV shows on the subject and different people have seen a number of different witnesses, even today, the high percentage of witnesses I've interviewed have never gone public. Most of these people still want no involvement. They want no publicity whatsoever. And a lot of these witnesses were, you know, youngsters, teenagers at the time. Many of these people grew up to be very reputable, professional people with, I mean, some very amazing backgrounds that some of these people later got involved with. And they have no reason to make up the story. They're seeking nothing. But what's so interesting is how their accounts fit with so many other people, and certain little details that over the years began to accumulate from different people. And so other people were able to verify other people's accounts. But even today, most of these people don't even know each other. And it's an incredible story. But again, what we now know is this. After this object fell, and I should go back to tell you that here's this fiery object apparently coming in over a long distance over the greater Pittsburgh area. It's tracking out roughly southeast towards Pittsburgh, but it, as it's heading out out towards 30 East, it makes a turn to the south, and it's seen by different people along these from these small communities moving out towards the mountains, out towards Laurelville. And out towards Laurelville, apparently it kind of hesitated, made a turn, began to track back towards Kecksburg, made another turn and went down into the woods. Amazing. And those people who saw it go down, they said it didn't come down at a high rate of speed. And so it was actually like a reentry of space debris, a meteor. But it came down almost, as some people describe, it was coming in on a speed of like a small aircraft on approach to an airport. Mm. And it dropped down into the woods almost like a controlled landing. And then right after that, there was like a column of bluish-gray smoke that went up out of the woods. But it dissipated very quickly.
Mm.
And again, what we didn't know at the time was that apparently a number of different individuals independently went down into the woods, and they came across this large metallic acorn-shaped object that was semi-buried in the ground. And best estimates, I mean, one witness who was relatively close to this thing, and again, it's dark, Danny had flashlights, and estimated this thing was probably about 10 to 12 feet or so in length, about 8 to 10 feet in diameter. And one witness, Jim Romansky, who never went public until we didn't find him, or rather, we didn't meet him or even know about his existence in 1987 when I was holding a very large public display at one of the local malls, and he and his family happened to walk by. We had a small little display on Kecksburg, and one of my associates was there talking to another man who was looking at it, and this fellow happened to overhear the conversation. He asked, "Are you talking about that thing that fell out in the Kecksburg area?" And he said, "Yeah," and he said, "Well, I was on the search team that found the object."
Really?
And, of course, his eyes perked up, and I was out for lunch or whatever, and they got a hold of me, and I talked to the man, and he didn't want to get involved or get his family involved, but he did acknowledge that he would meet with us and talk us more in detail about it. And he gave us, we spent quite a bit of time over a long period of time interviewing him, and he was not from Kecksburg. He was from another community not that far away, and he said how he got involved was he was a volunteer fireman, part of a volunteer fire department that had been called out to help assist in the search for a possible downed aircraft in that area. So they're out there on the way out, assuming they're going to be looking for an aircraft that had a problem. And anyhow, the story goes on that he and a number of other firemen came in from other departments. He didn't know these guys, and they came to the Kecksburg Fire Station, and they set up a grid search up in this large wooded area. And you remember how they put them in the trucks and left the searchers off at different areas to go up into the woods. And they had a two-way radio with them. And he said it wasn't long that there was a radio call from another team that they had come across the object which had fallen. So they hurried over, and here was several guys that stand there looking at this thing. And he's on a little embankment looking down at this thing just several feet away. And now Jim has been a machinist almost all his life. And he said the best way he can describe it was, he said, it looks like somebody took liquid metal and poured it into an acorn-shaped mold. He said it was kind of an unusual off-gold color. And the fact that it appeared not to have any rivets or seams or fuselage or weld marks on it. There was no markings on it, as he could see, as we would be able to identify. However, at the bottom of the object, the raised-up part that you would have, like, on the acorn, which he called, like, the bumper area, he said there were these raised-up markings that looked more like symbols than any type of writing.
Hieroglyphics?
And over the years after that happened, he began to make a lot of trips to the library to look at ancient languages and writings, and he said that the most similar that he could remember from what he saw would be closest to ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Hieroglyphics, yeah.
And he said, as they're watching this thing, they weren't that long. He said these two kind of stern men in trench coats came down into the woods, and they told these searchers, the firemen, they said, get out of the area right now. This area is, and I'm sorry, I'm not thinking a word of it right now, but you got to get out of the area right away. And anyhow, right behind them were soldiers. And he said they were so close to each other they could shine flashlights on each other. And they went back into town at that point. And, of course, the next day, the official explanation was that, you know, nobody had seen anything. You know, nothing had been found in the woods. They did conduct the search. And that officially they believed everybody saw a meteor in the sky. Well, that was 1987 is when we first met the first actual eyewitness, which was Jim Romanski, which he later appeared on the Unsolved Mystery Show in 1990 when they did the season premiere. Mm-hmm. A year after that happened, we got a tip that there was another local man who may have gotten down there shortly after it fell, but he never came forward, as so many witnesses did not on their own. I mean, even you know, in recent years, we'll get a person who knows somebody else and will tell them the story because they didn't report it, and the other person will call us and say, hey, I know this person who apparently was involved, but he never came forward. Mm. And that's kind of interesting because these people were not out to seek any publicity. Mm. And anyhow, that's what happened with the case of Bill Bullybush. So Bill Bullybush, we contacted him, and he lived right over the hill from Kecksburg, in a little town called Mammoth. And he didn't deny the story at all. He just said, hey, you know, my family knew about it, and, you know, we talked to a few people, and we kept our mouths shut like everybody else did. Hmm. When the government came out and said it was a meteor, and they said we saw something that wasn't a meteor, we just kept our mouths shut for years. And so anyhow, we ended up meeting with him. Now, what I should go back and tell you this part of the story, too, which is real interesting. After 87, when we met Jim Romanski for the first time, and he, again, was not from Kecksburg. He hadn't been out in that area since 1965 because, again, he was not from Kecksburg. But he said he would go out with us to the area. Well, we didn't tell him anything. Coincidentally, prior to that, myself and some of my associates were searching that wooded area where the thing reportedly came down. And we came across what we found to be very interesting. We came across a tree pattern, which there were trees knocked down in the same direction. There was damage at the top of some of the trees. There was an indication of what appeared to be a possible trajectory that went down into the bottom of the ravine through the woods.
Now, when is
and
it? Let me interrupt.
Anyhow, we didn't tell him that, and that very few people knew about it. We took photographs at the time, and we took him out to the area, and it's a big area. And he walked around for quite a while, and he took us into the areas, and we told him nothing. And he remembered certain details about the landmarks that night. And what it recalled, and he walked around there for quite a while, and he said, you know what, guys, I think we're right on the spot. Mm. My associate and I looked at each other, and it was right there in the really right in the immediate vicinity where we figured something may have come down as a result of the tree damage. We found the trajectory. Mm. So anyhow, we thought that was very interesting. Anyhow, the next year when Bill Bullybush, we get together with him, he takes us down from a different vantage point, because how Bill happened to see it, he was out in his driveway in his car working on a CB radio at the time, and he happened to look up to see this fiery object moving from Norvelt out towards the mountains, out towards Laurelville. So he jumps out of the vehicle, runs to the edge of the road, and he watches that thing. And he said it kind of hesitated, then made a turn and started to track back towards Kecksburg. Well, he jumped in his car and went to the top of the highest lookout, which they've now renamed that road as Meteor Road. And from up there, you can look over the whole area. It looks over all that wooded area. You can look over a whole general area around Kecksburg. It's a nice vantage point.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, it's almost dark. He had a flashlight with him. And he said he can see down in the woods. Now, he knew the woods because he hunted down there all the time. And there was these unusual, like, blue flashing. And he said it was like kids playing with sparklers. He said it was the best way he could describe it. And he knew whatever it was shouldn't be down there. So he was curious, and he grabbed his flashlight. So he's walking down from the top of the Meteor Road down through the woods, way down on the opposite side, which is a completely different vantage point from where Jim Romanski took us to a year before.
Mm-hmm.
So we're following him down. He's describing everything that happened, and we finally get over to the other side, and there's this tree, and he said, I stood right behind this tree, and he pointed over, and he said, that's where the object was. It was the exact same that Jim had taken us to the year before.
Exact same place.
Yeah. And these guys never met each other until after the Unsolved Mystery Show was being filmed. And then since that time, we've come across a number of other independent witnesses who had described the same area and described very much a similar type of experience of what they saw down there.
Right.
Now, in the summer of 1990, before the Unsolved Mystery Show aired, a man approached me, and I was able to check his background out. And he told me, he said, I was a part of the Air Force security team that guarded the object when it came in from Pennsylvania. And he was at Lockbourne Air Force Base outside of Columbus, Ohio. And he said he was there, part of the security team that guarded the object when it came into that base on the morning of December 10th outside of Columbus.
The object that was not supposed to
have
been.
The object that was recovered from Pennsylvania. He said they were notified it was coming in.
Yeah, but there
was. They brought it in from an entrance into the base that wasn't typically used, which another witness independently verified that for us also.
Mm.
And this guy doesn't know the other fellow, and as far as I know today, they don't know each other either. And he said the security on the base was much higher, for example, than when President Kennedy had visited the base prior to that.
Hmm.
He said they were given they backed the trailer truck with the object on into a hangar. And he said they were given a shoot-to-kill order to anybody who approached that hangar without the proper identification.
Jeez.
And he said he wasn't on that security team that long, but he heard that it didn't stay there that long. From there, it went over to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base near Fairborn, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other independent witnesses later told me that it came, in fact, to a warehouse building off of Wright-Patterson, and I mean, if we had access to the base, we could probably go right to that building today if it's still there. Now, if it's still there today, we have no way of knowing.
No.
But we believe that's where it did end up.
Hmm. Yeah, it's believed that Roswell debris ended up at Wright-Patterson. There are a lot of witnesses that claim that they flew Roswell debris to Wright-Patterson.
Right.
So that seems to be the place we take this stuff. You know, but first they said nothing came down, and then they said, and then you found witnesses that said, you know, I was part of the security team when they took this stuff in, when they took
right.
this object in.
Right. Well, it's not, it's just, there is so much, and again, there's so much information that I still haven't even put out there yet, because I'm still trying to verify certain little details, but there are so many independent people, like I said, that have never gone public. Most of the witnesses I've interviewed still have never gone public. Their stories are so interesting because of those details. And mainly I focused on what happened out there on the scene that night. And you got, you know, very reputable people, again, who were, most of them were teenagers at the time. And various people tried to sneak down into the woods that night to try to get to the impact site.
Mm.
But a number of them have gone on record, some publicly, some not publicly, that stated they were stopped by armed military personnel.
Yeah.
But what makes it more fascinating is you have some people who have gone public and said they were stopped by armed military personnel who aimed weapons at them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you got to understand, this being, if this is the facts, and I believe these people are telling the truth from what I can find, here you got soldiers coming into other people's private property and aiming weapons at other civilians, preventing them to get down into the woods to see what fell. So, again, over all these years, where did that jurisdiction come from? And what was so important down there that they didn't want certain people to see it?
That's it. I have to take a short break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves here in Henry Ford Community College out of in Dearborn, Michigan. And I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with Mr. Stan Gordon, a researcher and author. His book, one of his books, Really Mysterious Pennsylvania. That's the one I read, Really Mysterious Pennsylvania. And let's go back to this Kecksburg thing, because this is fascinating. You say there were somebody reported that there were men in trench coats and with military behind them. Why the trench coats?
They just said these two guys, and you know whether they were some local officials that got there quickly. It's just they had trench coats on. You know, the long trench coats, like over coveralls, like you know, if it's going to rain or whatever, that type of trench coat.
Yeah, but you're saying that the military took over, so the local authorities would not have been part of the picture. Am I correct?
Well, initially they were.
Oh.
I mean, the state police were initially involved.
Okay.
But it's very, very likely that once the military came in, that they were pretty much running the show what was going on out there that night.
How many of the witnesses have you interviewed turned out to be state police at that time?
I've interviewed, I can't say how many offhand, but at least several.
Hmm.
Several of these fellows have now deceased. In fact, that's what's a shame, because so many really good witnesses of the case have now passed away.
Yeah.
A lot of the witnesses are getting up in age. A lot of them are not in good health, and that's unfortunate.
But what was their testimony at the time?
On which ones now? There's so many different testimonies, many different witnesses.
Testimony.
Some people were just on the scene. Some people just saw the military activity and some military vehicles.
Mm.
Others got down to the scene. Much smaller numbers got down, apparently, and actually saw the object.
Okay.
Others saw the truck going out late that night, early the next morning. Of the area. So various, you got to look at the terrain of this area too. And, you know, people were at different locations, so there was different activity going on at different times in different parts of that community.
Mm-hmm.
So depending where you were, what was going on.
Well, of course, and another thing, this object, according to witnesses, this meteor, it was supposed to have been, made a turn or a couple of turns. Meteors don't do that.
Right, and it came down very slowly.
Now, meteors don't do that either. Well,
meteorites don't. And there was never reports of parachutes, for example, at the scene.
Right. Yeah, a lot of people have said that this bell-shaped thing was Russian satellite. Others, German technology that we were experimenting with. Is it possible that that could have been it?
You know, I've had numerous people approach me who said they knew without any doubt whatsoever that they had the solution of what the object was.
Mm.
And over the years, the last few years, the big thing has been now the German technology with the bell.
Right.
You know, this supposed anti-gravity type device that reportedly was Nazi technology that a lot of people are associating with the case. And back years ago, I mean, it started out with, of course, a Soviet satellite, a Soviet ICBM.
Mm-hmm.
I've had another person who contacted me and said that they knew it was some type of projectile that was fired from a giant gun from a railroad car in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The list just goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, I keep an open mind to all possibilities as to what this thing was.
Mm-hmm.
As I've said, could it have been something extremely sophisticated and man-made that even today we don't know about it?
Mm-hmm.
Possibility. You know, could it be extraterrestrial? Possibility. There's a lot of things we just don't know, and you know, we hope someday that we'll have definitive evidence to find out what it was. I'm convinced that an object of unknown origin, that means undetermined, you know, we don't know where it originated from. Mm. Doesn't mean extraterrestrial. Apparently fell and was recovered by the military. What it was still was open for a lot of options on there.
But then again, you're talking about if space debris, if something was up in orbit and it's coming down, it's not going to make U-turns. It's not going to slow down.
And right? Again, that's what so many different people tell us. And mm-hmm. we know from where different people were that apparently it did make, there was some, before it fell, apparently it made some change in the direction along that path before it fell down into the woods.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say you could determine this trajectory by what, some object that hit trees on the way down?
Well, again, that's what we found down in the woods.
Okay.
And there were trees knocked down in the same direction. Top of the trees were knocked out. It was quite interesting.
Was this right after the incident, or was this years later?
No, we didn't find this till a number of years later. Because back when that first happened, you know, again, there was not a lot of information on it officially. You know, people said nothing came down. And the few people we talked to, there was very little information on it. And it was a period of time after that that we began to get more information, began to find more witnesses. And finally, after many years, we got from independent witnesses, we were able to find the exact location where it fell.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't right immediately after it happened, no.
Okay. Weren't you on a TV show where they went back to Kecksburg and saw this trajectory?
Yeah, there have been a number of programs. I think you probably were talking about the Sci-Fi Channel.
Mm, possibly.
Which did a couple in-depth programs on the case. And also UFO Hunters was there more recently in the last couple of years.
Were you involved in that one?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I'm thinking of. Also, I had heard a story involving Kecksburg of a reporter that reportedly, no pun intended, went down there and found the object and was going to report on this bell-shaped object. And he had an unfortunate automobile accident on his way to his newspaper.
No, that's not correct. And we're hearing a lot of stories. That was John Murphy. He was the news director at WHJB.
Okay.
And John was apparently was the first reporter on the scene. He didn't ever come out publicly. He talked to, like, his wife at the time, and there were others who knew that apparently he got down into the woods before a state police fire marshal and another investigator got there. This is in the early times after it fell. And he supposedly came across the object and took some photographs of it.
Mm.
And I guess later on, he kept records on this thing, and this was the biggest story probably he had ever come across. And it was a very, very big story locally and nationally at the time, and he was right involved in it. And according to what we have heard, he did get some pictures at some point. We were told that some of the rolls of film he had were confiscated by some of the authorities on the scene, but apparently he was able to get a roll out, and more than one person said that they did see the black and white photograph that was down in the woods, but that has never surfaced.
We've heard
other accounts from different people who claim they saw photographs from that time period as well.
Mm.
None of those pictures have ever surfaced. About a week later, John Murphy and some of the other staff at the radio station, WHJB in Greensburg, they did a special radio show, a documentary called Object in the Woods, which was aired. But interestingly, it was aired in a censored fashion. In fact, the documentary that I did, which is on DVD now, is called Kecksburg, the Untold Story. And these are all available through my website, stangordon.info, also the books and the DVD. I have some of the actual audio footage from the censored broadcast at that time from WHJB. So he went and did that, but it was done in a censored fashion. And it wasn't until, this happened in 65, and I believe it was 69 that he was on vacation in California and was killed, was involved in an accident. And that,
okay.
I have never seen, and I've stressed this many times before, I've never seen any connection at all between what happened years later and his involvement at Kecksburg, even though some people believe there might be some quick connection there.
Yeah, well, a lot of people, you know, somebody dies years later and, it's because he said something years ago, but probably not. But at any rate, now going back to, I hate to get off of it. Is there anything else on any other evidence on Kecksburg that you want to get out there?
Well, I mean, we could talk for days and days about Kecksburg. It's a very, very fascinating account, and there are so many interesting, you know, individual accounts of what took place out there and what people saw and experienced. Mm. But, you know, again, it's one of those cases that we hope someday that somehow there'll be some definitive evidence that'll prove one way or the other what this thing may have been.
Mm.
And, again, I keep an open mind. Like I said, I'm convinced that something fell and the military recovered it. What it is still open to speculation. And it's just one of many, many thousands of cases I've been involved with over the years. And, of course, it's a case that's taken on a lot of national and international interest. And you know, hopefully someday we'll know more.
And once again, what's the name of your documentary on Kecksburg?
That's called Kecksburg, The Untold Story.
And people can check that out by going...
You can go to my website, which is stangordon.info, I-N-F-O.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll keep them aware of more recent cases of looking into UFOs, Bigfoot, other phenomena, and also my two books, Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Casebook, or Really Mysterious Pennsylvania. If they want to get a personalized autographed copy, they can order through the website. And, of course, it's available through Amazon and other places as well.
Right. So that's Stan Gordon. That's G-O-R-D-O-N.
.info.
And once again, so that I don't get involved in another conversation here and forget, I need to take a short pause to remind our listeners you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Stan Gordon. And, you know, we had the Pennsylvania State Director John Ventry on the show a couple of months ago. We were advertising the conference in Pennsylvania, both conferences. And I had to admit to him that I never paid much attention to the Bigfoot phenomenon because I didn't believe that they were UFO-related. And now I'm having second thoughts about that. What have your investigations into the Bigfoot phenomenon suggested along those lines?
Well, I'll tell you, the Bigfoot phenomenon to me is most fascinating, and that's why I wrote this book, Silent Invasion. And I don't know if you had the opportunity to read it yet, but it'll probably give a lot of the readers a completely different perspective on UFOs and Bigfoot. And again, well, let's go back a little bit to a number of years ago and how I got involved in this. You know, I started, again, back when I was very young, 10 years old, and I had an interest in all these types of phenomena. And there have been a long history of alleged Bigfoot sightings here in Pennsylvania. I mean, the Native Americans have talked about it. There was newspaper stories going back to the late 1800s. And people have been seeing something. Some of the earliest cases I recall, in fact, when I was in high school, I remember some of the kids coming up to me and telling me about these fellows and were going out with their dates into a kind of very wooded area out in Westmoreland County, not too far from the Chestnut Ridge area. And the Chestnut Ridge is an area that's about 100 miles long. It goes from Preston County, West Virginia, through Westmoreland, Fayette, and Indiana County. But it has a long history of all kind of phenomena being reported along the Chestnut Ridge.
Mm.
And the earliest firsthand account I have of a Bigfoot encounter goes back to 1931, from up in Indian Head in Fayette County.
Mm.
And Fayette County is a very active area year after year, including this year, for reports of Bigfoot activity. And anyhow, when I was in high school, the kids used to come in and talk about parking and having these, what they said looked like gorillas coming out of the woods and throwing rocks at their cars.
Hmm.
And years later, that would become an area that would become very, very active by with different people reporting Bigfoot-type encounters. But anyhow, in 1969, well, after the Kecksburg UFO case, I began to go out into the field to conduct firsthand investigations of these type of reports.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1969, I decided to set up a hotline for the public to report UFO sightings. So, again, I was relatively young, but I began to make contact with the local police and the news media and told them about what I was doing. And, well, if you know, back in those days, there was a tremendous amount of ridicule with the subjects, and I tried to handle it very cautiously and very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And made them aware, you know, that we're always taking this very seriously. And if they got reports, even if they would investigate, and if they let people know I was around, I would appreciate it. Well, in a matter of weeks and months, my phone was ringing off the hook. I mean, my phone was ringing day and night with calls coming in. And it wasn't just about UFOs. It was about strange animals, strange footprints, haunted houses, anything strange and unusual, I was getting calls on it. And I was just being inundated with reports. And I realized this was much more that I could handle on my own, that I needed people with scientific and research background to properly analyze this information. I was looking for scientists and engineers and technicians and research people.
Right.
And it was my goal to establish a volunteer research group like that. And the main goal was to try to set up as a quick response type of team or a group, that if a report came in, to try to get somebody out there quickly, hopefully while the phenomena was still active, or to get out there soon after while the evidence was still fresh. And that's what I did. So in 1970, I founded the first of three volunteer research groups I would get involved with from 1970. And in 1993, my last group ceased operation. I've been working independently as a researcher since then, mainly because it was all out of my own time and pocket. We were all doing this around our jobs, and it was very, very expensive. And these were big groups, a lot of people involved.
Right.
And anyhow, 1970, I founded the first group, the Westmoreland County UFO Study Group. And with my electronics background, we set up quite an elaborate communication center in my home. I designed a two-way radio dispatch system so we could radio dispatch some of the investigators out there to see these events in certain areas. And over the years, we got involved in hundreds and hundreds of cases. So by the time 1973 comes around, the group was already very active. It was getting to be quite well known. While we were dealing mainly in the around the Pittsburgh area, the group was getting reports by that time from across the state of Pennsylvania. And interestingly, we were beginning to get response from police departments and news media referring cases to us to investigate. Well, by 1973, some of your listeners will recall that we had that major wave of UFO sightings going on in the fall of 1973 throughout the United States. It was a very, very active year for UFO incidents. But it actually started here in the first day of the year and continued all year long across Pennsylvania. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of UFO cases being reported. And again, I will mention, if I haven't before, and this still is the same today as when I started many years ago, many UFO reports may seem very strange and unusual on the surface, but when they're investigated, most are determined to be either natural or man-made in origin. So there's a lot of things were misidentifications. But year after year, we still get cases you cannot easily dismiss. And back when I was investigating cases in the late 60s, 70s, to 80s, we had many of those very classic, very close, very detailed cases where not just lights were seen, but large structured craft.
Right.
And just some amazing cases that we looked into over the years. But going back to 1973, all these UFO sightings are going on. And many of them, again, were very detailed accounts of car chases and, you know, alleged landings and just amazing stuff, which is what I talk about in the Silent Invasion. So all this UFO activity is very, very active throughout the year. Then in the summer of 1973, things get much more interesting and much stranger. We have this major outbreak of Bigfoot sightings. It all began when I got a call from a relative not far, several miles from my house, on a rural area. It was a warm summer, and the person told me that the person involved just got out of the hospital the day she called me, which was August 7th. This had happened on July 31st. On July 31st, it was evening. Man was shaving in the bathroom like he normally did because he gets up early for work and he was shaving, and he started to smell this funny odor. He said it was like rotten cucumber. And he turned around to look in the bathroom window for whatever reason, and here's these two large glowing red eyes staring at him in the window. But the window is 8 feet off the ground. So he runs into the other room, and he yells at the other people, and they come out, and they smell the odor, but whatever was in the window was gone. And there were some dogs outside, but the dogs didn't bark, which they found was pretty unusual. Yeah. That was something we found to be very typical in a lot of the Bigfoot cases we'd begin to look into over next week's, several weeks and months. Anyhow, I went out to interview him that day on August 7th and talked to the witness, and he seemed very credible and scared him very badly, whatever it was that he saw. While we're there, we find out that a number of the local young boys, a number of weeks before, were taking a a shortcut over to the local mall, and something strange had happened. So I had a chance to interview some of those boys, and I was told that they had heard a commotion in the brush in the woods, and they thought it was a deer. So they began to throw some rocks in to scare the deer out.
Mm.
But instead of a deer, here comes this large, tall, 7-8 foot tall, hair-covered creature with long arms swinging, taking a large gate across the road and up behind the hill, up behind the house. So I got to talk to some of those boys, and I asked people on the property, "You mind if I go up and look around, and look around your property?" And they said, "Sure, go ahead." Some of the boys said, "Can we go with you?" And I said, "Sure, you come on along." So we were up there looking around, and the ground conditions were not real good. We stood up, went around there for a while, looking around, and I was about ready to leave. And just as I'm about to leave, I looked down, and right there on the ground is the strangest footprint I had ever seen. And again, there's a picture of it in the book. We made a casting of it. I called one of my other associates, and he came out, and we took photographs and measurements. And this thing was 13 inches long and 8 inches wide, but it's three-toed. Very clearly defined, very deep toes in the ground. And the kids are like all amazed, like, what could make that? And while we're out in the field, I get a radio call that another one of our investigators up north of Pittsburgh, Oklahoma City, Ohio line that morning was looking into a case where the police were involved, that a man had seen a creature with eyes about 9 feet tall looking in a window, and they had found some big footprints up there. So this is the beginning of this massive wave that went on for weeks and months over a large area of southwestern Pennsylvania and other areas of the state as well.
Hmm.
This went on to 1974. And, I mean, we had teams working on this 24 hours a day. I mean, we were getting calls. People were seeing these things, and in some cases, he had multiple creatures. In many cases, he had multiple eyewitnesses. There was various types of physical evidence, footprints and other evidence at the scene. It was amazing to get there within minutes after some of these events happened to see the reality, I mean, the human reaction, how upset people were,
right.
People with guns in their hands shaking, realized that something happened. So anyhow, just to make the story short, because I don't think you have much time left, we went in this initially with many, many years of thought that many of these Bigfoot reports appear to be some type of unknown primate. And that's something we always thought and considered as a possibility, excluding all the misidentification that people reported as well, which they do have also.
Right.
And but anyhow, as this series of events progressed, a lot of the reports began to come in, which were very, very strange. And some of these cases involved incidents where UFOs and Bigfoot were seen at the same time and place.
Mm.
Just to give you a couple examples. One of the first reports happened in a rural area where the wife of a prominent doctor, she had seen this large boomerang-shaped object hovering over the area that evening. And I believe it was a few hours later, right down the street, she began to hear gunshots. We found out later that a neighbor went out to see what was bothering the dog, to see this large, hairy creature going after the dog, and the guy started firing at it, and the thing ran into the woods.
Hmm.
So he thought, boy, that's fascinating. You know, here's a UFO sighting, and then you have this thing just around the road a short time later.
Yeah.
Then September 27th, up in Beaver County, north of Pittsburgh, there's two women out in the rural area waiting for a friend to pick them up, and they see this large, huge, hairy, man-like creature with white hair running across the road into the woods. And that was strange enough, but in one of its hands it had a small, luminous, glowing sphere of light. And they told the father of one of the girls about it, who owned the property, and he was apparently starting to go down in the woods to look for this thing. And while he was down there, this object approaches from in the sky. They thought it was an aircraft that slows down and projects a beam of light down into the woods.
Hmm.
And we began to get other reports. Some got much, much more interesting. And one of the most spectacular cases, which I detailed, we could talk for hours about this case because it gets extremely strange and unusual. But just the short version of it is October 25th of 1973. I get a call from a state trooper from the Uniontown Barracks up in Fayette County. He just came back from investigating this incident. We had two Bigfoot creatures in the field with a landed UFO at the same time.
Hmm.
Multiple eyewitnesses. It happened about 9 o'clock that night. About 15 people in this rural community, they see this object described about as big as a barn, but bright red, and hovering about 100 feet off the ground. And it's slowly making its way down as though it's going to land in this pasture. So the farmer's son was up there at the time. This was on his father's farm. And he went to another neighbor's house and got a look at it from a different perspective. And all these different people saw this thing, and he decided he was going to go up and investigate. So he and two neighbor boys decided to proceed. And before he did, he went over to his dad's house and grabbed a 30-06 rifle, some ammunition, which included two tracer rounds. So they would just give you like a bright burst of light. And again, to make the story short, they go up to the pasture, and this object was about 250 feet away, apparently right on the ground or right above it. But now it's estimated to be at 100 foot or more in diameter, but it's not spherical. It's like half a sphere. It's like a hemisphere with a flat bottom on the towards the ground. It's bright white. It's making this high-pitched sound. It's glowing and luminous. It's illuminating the whole area, and they're just amazed. They can't believe what they're seeing. And they're watching this thing and watching this thing, and then one of the other fellows yells, "Look over there." And there's a fence line. It's a barbed wire fence about 75 feet away. And there's these two figures slowly starting to walk in their direction, one behind the other. Well, at first, their first thought were, these are bear. Then they realize these things are bipedal. They're upright. One's around 8 foot tall. The other's about 7 foot tall. The bigger one's in front. They have very long arms hanging down almost to the ground, long, dark, matted hair. They have glowing green eyes. There's a smell in the air like burning rubber. These things are making this high-pitched crying sound, and they're walking in their direction. Well, the one boy is getting very, very upset, and he finally they're yelling at the guy, "Shoot him, shoot him." And at one point, the one boy runs out of the field. The other two are standing there, and he finally fires. And he fires the first as a tracer, so it's just a flash of light. He fires the second tracer. And when he fires that second tracer, the largest of the two creatures makes a whining sound and reaches out as if to grab that tracer round at that flash. And the moment it does that, the object in the field just vanishes and disappears. It doesn't take off. It's gone. The light goes out. The sound stops. It's not visibly there anymore. Wow. The creatures turn around and slowly start walking back towards the field, toward the woods, I should say. And at that point, he fires with the lime ammunition right into him. He said, "I've been hunting for years." He said, "These things are, their eyes are staring at us, so looking right at them." And he said, he's sure he hit the big one, but there was no indication was harmed in any way, didn't slow down at all. And they run out of there and go back to the farmhouse, get the family out of there, take them to a neighbor's and call the state police. So about 45 minutes later, the trooper arrives on the scene. "I'm here to investigate the flying saucer report." And the witness goes on to say, "Look, just, you know, forget it. You know, I don't want to get involved in it. You know, you're not going to believe me anyhow." And he said, "Well, I have to investigate because we had a report the night before, last night, of two similar creatures up on the mountain." So anyhow, they went up in the troop car. And what the trooper told me, he said, the whole area where that object was on the ground was self-luminescent and glowing, about 100, 150 feet or so in diameter.
The ground was luminous?
Yeah, right. Wow. He said it was bright enough that if he had a newspaper, he could have sat down within it and read from the light coming off that area. He said it felt a little bit warmer inside of it than outside of that area. The farm animals wouldn't go anywhere near it. And again, the story goes on, and it's just a fascinating account. So that and other cases we had. And then we began to get some other strange other events. For example, we would get caught out on some of the incidents where there had been trails of footprints. In some cases, we found that the footprints suddenly stopped and vanished, where there should have been more tracks. But anyhow, as the book Silent Invasion goes in, there are many different events. We just slightly began to talk about it. And there was information in there that will, I think, give you other possibilities of what we're dealing with. You know, I've said for years and years, especially after these events happened, you have all these large numbers of alleged Bigfoot sightings throughout the United States and other parts of the world. Right. People see them year after year. I mean, we have sightings of Pennsylvania here pretty much every year. Some of them appear to be very legitimate. People are seeing something. The point is, why don't we have a body, just like a lot of the skeptics
right.
say? If these are real physical animals, by now, somebody surely would have shot one, hit one with a car, found a body somewhere.
It just doesn't
make sense.
They'd die of natural causes, and you'd find a corpse. Or
right, and no matter how rare an animal is, and you rarely find some of the bodies and
right.
you know, in the woods, you have them, you know they exist.
Right, right.
But in this case, none have ever shown up.
Mm.
And when you get into some of the cases we investigated back at that time, it strongly suggests that there may be more than a flesh and blood explanation of what we're dealing with, as strange as it sounds.
Maybe.
And I don't have the answer. And once again, as I've pointed out, I don't know what, if any, direct connection exists between UFOs and Bigfoot, but there's some very, very interesting cases out there, and it's not just in Pennsylvania.
Right.
I mean, I can tell you that historically there's always been, you know, a ridicule involved, especially in this aspect of it, because those involved with UFOs, and those especially who believe these things are extraterrestrial, which some of these may well be, some of the UFO sightings, don't want to connect Bigfoot and UFOs, and vice versa. Many people in the Bigfoot field who believe things are strictly some type of biological creature don't want to associate them with UFOs. Well, I've gotten to the position where I don't have the answers as to what was going on. I was there as an investigator. We gathered the information. I presented what we've learned. I don't have the answers.
That's right.
There's something going on out there, and I keep an open mind to all aspects of the phenomena. I don't know what we're dealing with, but there's more to it than meets the eye.
And for every question that is answered, 10 more are posed. Is that right?
Oh, definitely.
Maybe not extraterrestrial, but other dimensional.
And that's a possibility, too, because some of these cases suggest that there was a physical and a non-physical aspect of what we were dealing with.
Right, right. Tell us again where we can learn more about your work, Stan.
They can contact me through my website, which is www.stangordon.info, and also email is paufo@comcast.net, which is on my website as well.
Okay. Stan Gordon. Stan, I really appreciate you getting with us and talking to us today. I hope we can do this again sometime, because I got a feeling that I'm being facetious. I know that there is a lot more information that you could impart for us.
Well, as you saw from Really Mysterious Pennsylvania, there's a lot of very strange, other than Bigfoot, other creature sightings.
Right.
A lot of weird stuff goes on here year after year, and many interesting reports just from this year alone.
Right, right. Stan Gordon, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. And We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. Now please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mystery.